And promotion from one degree to another was, of course, available only to those who evinced the capacity for progressing at least a stage or two toward the insane nihilism of the inner circle. The rest were kept in lower grades proportionate to their capacities. As Weishaupt wrote to one of his colleagues, urging more intensive recruiting of neophytes, "These good people swell our numbers and fill our money box. Set yourselves to work. These gentlemen must be made to nibble at the bait. But this sort of people must always be made to believe that the grade they have reached is the last." Thus it was that a conspiracy for the destruction of all European nations was able to enlist among its members some of the reigning princes of Germany. And a conspiracy for the abolition of Christianity was able to enlist Christian theologians. The latter Weishaupt regarded as the best joke of all. He wrote, "The most wonderful thing of all is that the distinguished Lutheran and Calvinist theologians who belong to our order really believe that they see in it the true and genuine mind of the Christian religion. Is there anything you cannot make men believe?" The Bavarian branch of the Illuminati was suppressed, at least temporarily, in 1786. But the Bavarian government naturally could do nothing about the branches in other countries, and these preserved their secrets intact. I am not here concerned with any of the attempts that have been made to sketch the later history of the conspiracy. I'm interested only in the ascertained facts attested by published documents, and in these primarily as an illustration of phenomena that we may expect to find repeated many times in our own society. Weishaupt's Illuminati provide us with a perfect working model of conspiratorial activity among intellectuals. They show how easy it is for adroit criminals to enlist and manipulate educated suckers. And above all, bring us face to face with the highly distasteful fact that mankind does produce creatures like Weishaupt and his confederates in the inner circle. All these are important points. Each would repay detailed examination. In the activities of our intellectuals, we see time after time clear indications of conspiratorial cohesiveness and a coordination of efforts that strongly suggests conspiratorial, that is to say, central direction. If, for example, you examine the carefully documented publication of the Veritas Foundation, Keynes at Harvard, you cannot escape the author's conclusion that, and I quote, "Keynesism is not an economic theory. It is a weapon of political conspiracy." And you cannot fail to see that the authors are certainly right when they say that the Fabian socialists have used the conspiratorial techniques of the Communist Party with the obvious intention of destroying the American Constitution. Now, without attempting at this time to decide whether the Fabian socialists are a subsidiary of the Communist conspiracy or an independent group that happens to be working for virtually the same ends, we must note the important point that it operates as a conspiracy and ask ourselves whether this coordination of effort can be adequately explained in terms of some blind instinct, such as that which sets a colony of termites to work in harmonious cooperation for the destruction of a house, or whether it presupposes conscious direction from day to day. That is an important question, for we see the same kind of phenomenon, less obvious perhaps, but distinctly perceptible in almost all areas of activity. The intellectuals are influential not as individuals, but as gangs operating for the same general ends, usually with a high degree of coordination. And this coordination becomes really remarkable when you observe it in matters that do not affect a obvious common interest. Under modern conditions, for example, since the country has been covered with this film of public schools, it may be only natural for a swarm of so-called educators to cooperate perfectly in hunting down their common prey, the taxpayers, and to attack viciously anyone who disturbs them as they sink their proboscises deeper and deeper year after year. There is obviously a common interest. But now, what conceivable common interest could they have had in abolishing the House Committee on Un-American Activities? What envisaged profit could inspire a statewide gang to turn like a wolf pack on a superintendent of schools who sponsored a speaker who spoke unkindly of the communist conspiracy? Why should one of these packs, as happened in Wisconsin last year, turn on a professor of education, yes, of education, mind you, and hunt him out of the academic world because he spoke respectfully of the American Constitution and had dared to suggest the teachers of American history really ought to read it sometime? You see, how could that man's view, how could his opinion, how could his public statement have diminished the educators' collective annual take from the exploited and enslaved taxpayers of Wisconsin? You must assume some other motivating force beyond any perceptible immediate financial interest to the persons involved. Now, that's why I fear that the intellectual shysters are too well organized, and that in the many branches which they work, whether they all know it or not, they behave as tentacles of a single octopus and are therefore subject to a single central control. And in any case, you can't hope to educate the shysters. They already know what they are doing. At the very least, they know that they are witch doctors living by their wits and battening on the credulity of the American people. But, to return to the question with which we started, can liberals be educated? What about the intellectual suckers, the literate and well-meaning dopes like Professor Chalet and Madame Durfee and the rest? Can they be educated? Is there anything that we can teach them from books or show them by reason and argument to make them less fatally gullible? Or, if that cannot be done, are they at least intelligent enough to learn from experience when they see that they have been hoaxed? Some, no doubt. There have been several recent books by John Dos Passos and Edmund Wilson, for example, by honest liberal intellectuals who give most encouraging indications that they are beginning to grow up now that they are past 60 or 70. But the proportion, I'm afraid, is small. I do wish that one of those busybodies who are forever making statistical studies would make a statistical study that would mean something, a statistical study of the capacity of intellectuals to learn the obvious. There is an abundant material for dozens of studies of that kind, but here is just one example of what could be determined with some mathematical precision and by the expenditure of much less effort and of much less money than goes into some learned university studies. For example, the research conducted 2 years ago by a leading university to determine whether the size of pancake preferred by men differs from the size of pancake preferred by women. As we all know now, the international communist conspiracy, coordinating the efforts of its divisional headquarters in New York, Washington, and Moscow, used your money to install in Cuba in January 1959 a notorious communist agent named Fidel Castro, and started to work immediately to install military and naval bases including submarine pens and ballistic missiles, 90 miles from our shores. Of course, the conspiracy, through its various outlets, such as the New York Times and other lie papers, poured out hogwash about agrarian reformers and the George Washington of Cuba. And it was only to be expected that our intellectuals, who had swallowed exactly the same swill a few years before when the United States delivered China to the communist conspiracy, would lap it up again with relish. I'm not complaining about that. It's true that there was no possible doubt about the fact that Castro was a communist agent carrying out a communist operation. In a speech which some of you may have heard, it takes me a full hour to give a condensed resume of the evidence that was available to everyone before 1959. All of it on the public record and some of it in the files of every large newspaper, which proved beyond all peradventure of doubt that Castro and all of his real lieutenants were Bolsheviks. But I'm not going to say that our liberals should have looked at the evidence. As we all know, intellectuals are equipped with oversized brains that perpetually fizz with social ideals. So perhaps it really would not be fair to expect them to find out what they are talking about. As soon as Castro came to power in Cuba, Mr. Robert Welch and Dr. J.B. Matthews in the pages of American Opinion, and if you will pardon me for mentioning it, I, in speeches before the Daughters of the American Revolution, the Congress of Freedom, and other organizations, pointed out the obvious facts about Castro and the Soviet takeover of Cuba. You may remember how the liberal intellectuals began to shriek and spit at us. But I'm not complaining about that. We all know that intellectuals have mighty minds, capable of remembering the phrases that the communists teach them. So whenever they are disturbed by facts, they naturally start shrieking, reactionary, fascist, right-wing extremist, racist, and the like. And one shouldn't mind their spitting, really. After all, cats do that, you know. And for that matter, benevolent nature has equipped another puny creature, the polecat, with a means of making itself important in the world. So we should not be so extravagant as to suggest that our intellectuals could have learned the obvious in 1958 or 1959 or 1960 or most of 1961. Although, of course, the evidence not only about Castro but about the Soviet installation of missiles and other weapons aimed at the United States accumulated day by day. Probably big minds shouldn't be bothered with evidence. But here is a point that is worth considering. During the summer and autumn of 1961, the communist subsidiary called Fair Play for Cuba, which of course had been thoroughly exposed as a communist front for that time, sent up smoke screens for Comrade Fidel on a national scale, using, of course, a great many liberal intellectuals in the faculties of our colleges and universities. Those persons went on record publicly as endorsing Castro, guaranteeing that he was a sweet and lovely Democrat and social reformer, and even demanding in some cases that he be given his own pipeline direct into the Treasury in Washington. As I say, these people went on record publicly, signing manifestos and inserting full-page advertisements in newspapers. In some universities, as many as 300 individuals connected with the faculty or administration went on record in that way. The total throughout the country must be thousands. Now, undoubtedly, the organizers of those manifestos and some of the signers knew very well what they were doing. They just said to one another, we've got to keep those American boobs quiet until the Soviet bases are all completed. And as soon as that is done, we'll say, oops, there's communists in Cuba after all. And we'll run out and scare the boobs by yelling atomic holocaust, annihilation of mankind, negotiated peace, better red than dead. That was, of course, obviously planned by the organizers. But it's only charitable to suppose the majority of the signers of those manifestos were just intellectual suckers who actually believed the tripe to which they affixed their names. Now, as you may remember, in December 1961, Sweet Fidel made monkeys out of those supermen by going on the radio and boasting that he had been a Bolshevik ever since he was a boy. At that point, the suckers must have realized that they had been had. The whole list of signers stood exposed before the American public, including their own colleagues and the residents of the communities in which their diploma mills were located, stood exposed as either traitors or jackasses. And I don't see how they could have failed to feel a teeny whit embarrassed, at least. When a normally intelligent human being has been swindled, he sits down and reviews very carefully the sources of information on which he relied, the weaknesses in himself, and the tricks of the confidence man who took him in. And he tries to make sure that he will not be caught again in the same way. That's what ordinarily intelligent and prudent people do. And I should think that it is not too much to expect of intellectuals. But it is a curious and perhaps significant fact that, so far as I have been able to learn, not one peep was heard from all of those thousands of superbrains the day after Castro made his announcement, or the week after, or the month after, or the year after, or down to the present time. Now, it is possible, of course, that the poor suckers were so embarrassed that they kept quiet in the hope that their friends and neighbors would charitably forget their humiliation and disgrace. And I certainly would not be so cruel as to wish to remind them of that past. But what I should like to see is some investigator make a sociological study. All he would have to do is compile the names, which, as I have said, are all on record in print, and then ascertain how many of the signers are still out communist fronting and whooping it up for unmistakable communist apparitions such as disarmament or civil riots in the race war that is now being waged against white Americans. Until such a statistical investigation has been made, it would be a little venturesome to guess what percentage of liberal intellectuals are intelligent enough to learn from their own experience. And certainly those who cannot learn in that way could never be educated in any other way. Without statistics, any opinion that may be offered must necessarily be a mere guess. And I certainly don't want to seem discouraging, ladies and gentlemen, but my guess, my best guess for what it may be worth, is that among honest intellectuals, the percentage of recovery is comparatively small. They may mean well, but like confirmed alcoholics, they have acquired the habit of escape from reality into the wonderland behind the looking glass. If candid, they would have to say of themselves what one of their idols, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, admitted to Boswell at an unguarded moment. I cannot tolerate the world as it is. I must live in a world of fantasies. Such habits, once acquired, are extremely hard to break. And that is why I fear that many liberal intellectuals, like so many alcoholics, won't be able to get along without their hooch.
Would that I had the gift to give him hell like he can. I don't think anybody has the mastery of the English language to do it quite so well, Doctor. We want to let you know. That we deeply appreciate it.
And now, a final word about the organization that made this series of tapes possible, the National Alliance. Your speaker, Kevin Alfred Strom. You who are listening to this tape, and I who produced it, do not know each other. I do not know how you came upon this speech. But what I do know, with a fair degree of certainty, is this. You share with us a concern for the future of our race and nation, for our children, and for our children's children. You share with us dismay and revulsion at the growing degeneracy of our society. You share with us profound misgivings about the wisdom of turning our beloved America into a third world slum. One thing that should give you some consolation is the fact that you are not alone. More and more Americans are withdrawing from the political process, believing it to be an exercise in futility, a farce in which the voter has no real choice. On America's campuses, the dictatorship of the politically correct is being openly challenged. Winds of change are starting to blow. With each new hate crime law, with each new affirmative action program, with each new interracial situation comedy, with each new gun confiscation law, and with each new wave of third world immigration, the vast and angry army of the disaffected grows. What then can be done? This vast army of disaffected white Americans presents us with an opportunity. But the task before us is immense and difficult. The power and money of the enemy seem limitless. Even taken as a whole, the patriotic forces in this country at this time are totally unequal to any contest for power. These cold, hard facts, unpleasant as they are, help us refine our strategy and direct our efforts toward what is actually possible. As Dr. William Pierce said at the first general convention of the National Alliance, our task is not to persuade a numerical majority of the American population that we are right, but rather to build the numerical minority whose values coincide with ours into a majority of will and determination. For it has always been dedicated minorities that have been the makers of history. The majority will stand on the sidelines in every conflict until they are forced to act. Of course, these facts do not free us from the responsibility to recruit large numbers of people, many tens of thousands more than we have now. But we must always keep in mind that we are recruiting an elite, a vanguard group that will be able to build a professional organization and an uncompromising movement that one day will lead the masses of our people out of their slavery and degradation. There is much to be done. The National Alliance needs many different kinds of members. We need writers and carpenters, physicists and photographers, architects and actors, businessmen and artists. We need those who see the necessity of our task and are willing to give everything they've got to the effort. We need members who can inspire that kind of dedication in others, members who will lead lives of exemplary sacrifice and devotion. You may think we're asking a lot. Too much, perhaps. We do this because we are serious about winning this struggle for our people. We do this because we can't afford to waste our efforts. The stakes are too high. We ask for members who will bring real resources, skills, and abilities to the problems at hand, and we ask for members with exceptional dedication, patience, and persistence, because nothing less will do the job. Presently, the National Alliance has, through National Vanguard Books, the ability to inspire and educate the best elements of our people. We will continue this effort on an ever-increasing scale. We will select from these individuals those who are willing to become supporters or active participants in our efforts. We will expand our capabilities, not only increasing the publication and distribution of printed materials, but branching out into other areas, including radio and television. National Alliance spokesmen will appear more and more frequently on college campuses, on radio talk shows, and on television news programs. As our capabilities increase, we will begin to produce our own radio and television programs to be aired on cable systems as well as on purchased commercial airtime. And always, the impression conveyed to the public will be one of strength, intelligence, truthfulness, and professionalism. I hope that you will subscribe to National Vanguard and that you will avail yourself of the marvelous educational opportunity offered by the National Vanguard Books catalog and its recommended reading list. As you examine and consider the books and magazines that we publish and distribute, and as you hear the words of great patriots in this series of speeches, I hope you'll come to understand that no other organization has the skilled personnel, the seriousness, the understanding of fundamental principles, the fighting spirit, or the realistic chance for ultimate success of the National Alliance. Despite the decadence of our nation and our race's peril, you and I are lucky to be living in these times. Unlike the nationalists of Eastern Europe before the fall of communism, we do not have to work in secret. Our publications are not yet outlawed. Our freedom of speech has not yet been completely stifled. But if we fail, if patriotic white Americans do nothing, then all these things, and worse, much worse, are coming. If you think you have what it takes, then I'm asking you to join us. Whether you can best serve by joining your efforts to ours here at the National Office, or in the role of an activist and spokesman for our cause, or as an influential member of society, helping our work with influence and intelligence from behind the scenes, or as a supporter, providing the necessary financial and physical infrastructure that makes all our other work possible. You now have an opportunity to become a part of our great movement for the cleansing and restoration of our nation and civilization. Future generations, if there are any, will look with favor upon those who did their duty. Write us for membership requirements. Our address is National Alliance, Post Office Box 90, Hillsborough, Virginia 24946.